Welcome to Chit Chat Money. Today is Tuesday, May 18th. Today we have no interview. Sorry to disappoint. So it's just Brett and I. We have a interesting segment though. We're going to talk best moats of all time. We've ranked our top 10. We're just going to rattle them off back and forth, kind of give a little commentary on that. And then we have our traditional sort of more show notes commentary from the week. But before we get to that, sales pitch time. Our flagship sponsor, our partners at 7 Investing, you can use our code CCM. It's officially been, what, a year and a month now? Like getting that right?
Yeah, they're heading into, a year and 2 months. They're cruising into their second year. There's been some market volatility recently in some of the high growth names, as we know. So some of those prior recommendations or recent ones may be at a better valuation right now, or they might not be. We don't want to spoil anything, but there's opportunities abounding.
I might also add that this is when having a services feels more worth it to me, because those tech companies that usually, I guess they have a wide range of sort of expertise, but Simon's very good with tech. Max is good with tech. I guess Matt's good with tech as well. Steve and Honorbon also are, Dana too, I guess the whole
most,
team.
Most the whole team, yeah.
A lot of them have had premium valuations, so I really look forward to this upcoming month of recs. But that's all for that. Just use our code CCM, you get $10 off. Without further ado, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Chit Chat Money. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer interview industry experts and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Money is a CCM Media Group podcast. Ryan and Brett are also general partners at Arch Capital, and Arch Capital may have positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Money by Ryan or Brett or any other podcast guests is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
All right, welcome in. We're going to kick things off with our moat rankings. So we've ranked our top 10. We're going to start from 10. We're going to alternate. Do you want to go first? Do you want me to go first?
Go ahead and go first. I kind of just have them listed out, and then I have just like two or one bullet points of why. So kind of list it out and give a quick reason why. Probably be good. We can take up like 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
Something like that.
My 10th, which lowest on the totem pole here, and I couldn't necessarily characterize why. And so you've kind of done, have you done old ones or newer ones?
They're all around today. Some of the moats may have been better in the past, but they're all relevant today. So
okay, it's kind of hard to call it a great moat if it's not around today.
If
anymore,
it eroded today, that means it wasn't actually as good as people thought. Yes, you're right.
But my 10th one is Chipotle. Kind of a shocker here, obviously.
That's a wild card. I did not think of that one. All right, why?
I don't know. I think the, as far as restaurants go, if you had to pick one to have any moat,
I'd pick McDonald's and Domino's, but really? I think Chipotle's up there.
Yeah, like I said, I couldn't characterize why, but when I think about the ones that have the largest lock-in with me as restaurants, Chipotle is one. Probably the top one.
Yeah, they got brand equity, I guess. That's a real thing, I guess. They built it up over even past the E. coli thing. That is an interesting start, though.
When I put it down, it just kept going lower and lower on my rankings because I realized I couldn't exactly categorize why it has a moat. But the company's done quite well, and it's the ingredients.
Yeah,
it's the special recipe.
The
secret formula.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a secret formula for rice and beans, but I think they are. I guess you could argue they're building it up over time. In 5 years, it could be a lot stronger than it is today. I think there's an argument to be made there. Yeah.
Okay. What's your 10th?
My 10th is going to be Home Depot. I'm thinking strong decades of brand equity and economies of scale is really strong here.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of think of it as similar to Costco, which is higher up on my rankings, but Costco kind of executed in building that moat a little better. I mean, Home Depot is one of the top performing stocks of all time. I think it's like a 500 bagger since inception, or probably higher now from when I last looked. So the execution was obviously strong versus like almost every other business, but the moat, you know, of like, all right, low prices, good, you know, brand equity with consumers, we're going to treat everyone well. The employees are going to be paid well, and they're going to actually provide value to like the shoppers at the store. That experience that people have, I think it's very similar, and it's really, really hard to penetrate that moat. I mean, there's a second player there that Lowe's, but it seems like kind of one of those duopolies that, at least in the United States, is very rational. And I think that's because they both have really strong moats.
Yeah. That was definitely one I considered putting on my rankings. I thought you'd have that one. My ninth, though, is Nintendo. I guess we are biased shareholders.
Talking our book with this one, yeah.
But the IP, I think, is pretty timeless. No matter what system you put it on, as long as gaming is a large part of life, I think Mario, they own part of Pokemon. Companies like that are always going to be around. It's just a staple of gaming.
Yeah, IP stuff, entertainment stuff's very simple. I mean, you have to, you know, the moat can be there and you might not be good at it. Kind of like with I think it was Fox with that DC comic stuff. Really, you know, big comic book business, just like Marvel, but Disney executed a lot better with Marvel. But
the other thing I'd add,
or go ahead.
The other thing I'd add is it's that you extract all the oil, the whole Buffett quote, you extract the oil and then it seeps back down into the ground every 5 years or so because you can just repeat the same game. How many Mario Karts have there been?
Each one's a good seller. I think there's been 8 or 10. Well, if you don't count the mobile ones, yeah. I mean, it's clear. The IP ones, the entertainment ones, people overlook them, I think, because they're so simple. But it's really just black and white. You either have it or you don't. And it's built up over decades, so.
All right, what's your ninth?
Okay, my ninth one, I think this is the only other one that we own. So it's going to sound like we're just talking our book on this ninth one. But Autodesk, and you could probably argue this for a few other of those workplace software things. Basically, the whole thesis on why this software like Autodesk and their products, which if you don't know, basically provides the, you know, design tools for the manufacturing world and the architecture, engineering, and construction industries. There's competitors as well, but the argument is that they have extremely high switching costs. I would argue one of the highest switching costs of any software or product in the world, and that is because it takes hours and hours and hours to learn the software. And now, on top of that, they have strong brand equity with a few of their popular products that gives them phenomenal pricing power. Now, you could argue that you don't want to squeeze them out so much, or I don't know what the analogy would be, where you anger your customers by using that pricing power
mortgage
too much.
Mortgage the moat.
Yeah, thank you. And then also on top of that, there are network effects because of the steady cross-communication between teams of software products like this. So, you know, different people within the AEC industries, architecture, engineering, construction, and manufacturing, they're sending files to each other. And there's definitely other companies besides Autodesk. There's, you know, Ansys, I'm thinking of just off the top of my head. I don't know that company that well, but there's Dassault. I mean, you can also argue stuff like Adobe is similar to this.
They kind of all have their own niche, though.
Yeah, and the reason I put Autodesk is it seems like they, within especially the number one product they have, Revit, that one specifically has one of the strongest moats in the world.
It's like 90% market share, right?
Yeah, 90, I think they have high switching costs, great brand equity because everyone loves the product, even though if they sell it for a high price. And yeah, there's network effects from all the communication people have.
It's the David, you know, the David Gardner quote where it's like, if this company disappeared tomorrow, what would happen?
The construction industry would slow down. It's part of the supply chain of it, really.
Right. And I think a lot of customers wouldn't be able to operate for probably a good 2 to 3 months.
Yep. But,
all right, my eighth one, waste management. This is sort of a regulatory moat because you have to get stuff for landfills.
Yep.
And not to mention the barriers to entry is just that it's not attractive. No one wants to be. It's not. There isn't a lot of venture dollars going into collecting trash. And I guess it's just a less sexy industry to be in, and it requires certain regulatory approvals
limited licensing. Yeah.
Regulatory barriers to entry are usually like, I mean,
I guess
it's not necessarily the company I would own, but it solidifies the moat pretty strongly.
Just because you identify a moat doesn't mean the company is a good investment. And I guess Lockheed Martin, I forgot about them. I may have put them on the list if I thought about them. They have the ultimate one of these, I think. Very similar to waste management.
Yeah, Boeing, maybe they have a lot of government contracts.
Yeah, Boeing as well. Yeah, and waste management also has economies of scale, potentially small one, just because it's hard to get all that stuff, you know? It's hard to get it all up and running, that whole system of waste management.
Definitely requires, I mean, they have quite the fleet.
The fleet, the landfills, all that stuff.
All right, what's your eighth?
Okay, eighth is Philip Morris or Premium Cigar or Cigarette Makers. So the regulatory capture here relates well for what you just said. It creates that barrier to entry, and then there's that restriction on advertising that kind of embeds the incumbent, so it's really hard to enter the market if you can't tell your consumer what your product is, so outside of the limited stuff within the stores.
Does that encompass Altria, your Philip Morris pick?
Well, yeah, Philip Morris is all true. I mean, yeah, okay. Just all of these, you know, cigarette makers. I mean, this, you know, this is a you know, obviously huge durability concerns with this one. There's, I think, Focus Compounding, which if you like our show, you probably like some of the stuff they do. They do a lot of writing on, like, you know, philosophy of investing, stuff like that. They talked about the difference between a moat, which is what we're describing today, versus durability. The durability of the cigarette industry is obviously a huge concern. And this is kind of a unique situation, not very repeatable, where it became the ultimate sin industry. Everyone hated it, but the moat is almost impenetrable at this point. It's just the worry about the actual demands and the cultural things. And, you know, the moat of the cigarette products are huge, but there's the vaping stuff and all the innovation and other ways that can chip away at this moat. Or not even chip away at this moat, just take, like, markets, take the consumer somewhere else.
Yeah, this cracked my list as well. I put it down as Altria, but it's, I mean,
same thing, yeah.
Market share within the cigarette industry, Marlboro's, has been north of 40% for the last decade. It's been high.
Longer, yeah.
I don't know if it was above 40% prior to that, but now it's at 43%. Yes, there is, it's hard to refute that their moat within cigarettes is basically impenetrable, but obviously underlying trends of the industry as a whole aren't that promising. So you might have a moat within something, but don't miss the forest for the trees.
Yeah, durability, I guess, is something, you know, you always have to think about durability as well.
Yeah, all right. Is that me now?
Yeah, you're seven.
Seventh, Disney, kind of the same thing as Nintendo.
Yeah, Disney's on my list.
I think Buffett's talked about this. It's the they can tap into that same IP they've always had. It's hard. You can't – it feels like you can't just manufacture – that sort of IP, that share in the customer's mind. I don't know. It's a big one that Buffett's always talked about, and it's timeless.
Yep, I agree. I have a few other things, but I'll save it for my ranking when I bring it up. All right, my seventh is going to be Coca-Cola. Again, boring. Everyone knows this one, but I would argue they have the number one brand equity in the world, which that's kind of a vague one from a moat standpoint, but it is real. And you can maybe argue Nike, Apple, a few others are close, but I think over the last, it's been over a century, they've been at this peak where, you know, Apple and Nike's been a little bit of a less time, although it's probably, you know, they're bigger companies. I think Nike's bigger.
I would.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Coca-Cola is obviously the one that comes to mind because that's sort of the, you hear Buffett talk about the moat all the time when you listen to the old shareholder meetings and stuff like that. But I think they might be going through, I guess I don't have the data.
It's durability concerns.
The same thing as Altria.
Yeah, durability concerns.
Market share is fine, but how's the underlying category doing?
Yeah, and then the thing I had here is if you're thinking about, okay, well, I'm confused. Why would Coca-Cola have a moat? I think the proof is in the simplicity of the product. So they've ingrained the world through a century of advertising about what – bottle of Coke means, and they basically try to make it mean happiness in a broader terms. And the simplicity of the product, it's very easy to copy, but why have they stood the test of time? It's because they have that brand equity built up over decades and decades and decades. And you could argue, okay, soda consumption is going down, but you know, when people are drinking soda, it's most likely going to be Coke or Pepsi too, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Sixth for me, Autodesk, similar to you. It's something that I think the customers couldn't live without.
Yeah, talking our book, yeah.
You can kind of tell by the pricing power, which hope they don't. And at one point, I believe one of the customers just wrote an open letter like, hey.
They got a group of architects together, yeah.
Saying, listen, we all know we can't live without it. Just please stop pricing.
Yeah, don't be so aggressive, or it's going to ruin their cash flow and profitability. So they wanted to make they were like, hey, keep the ecosystem better. And I guess, you know, that could be mortgaging the moat, but you know, it shows that it's there.
Yeah, definitely. All right, what about you?
Six. Okay, I have Disney here at number six. You talked about the IP, but I like to talk about the theme parks as well. That gives them economies of scale. People really underrate the amount of capital investment that needs to go into these Disneyland and Disney World. I mean,
yeah,
what did they spend on Galaxy World? That small Star Wars part was like $4 billion. I mean, the cap, also, the embedded PP&E is billions and billions of dollars there.
When you can make that experience strong, it I hate to use the word flywheel effect, but I think it gives people a personal relationship to the franchises or the intellectual property that you have.
Yep, I also have the vertical integration through the three streaming services. This is kind of a developing moat because it's really early on, yeah. But that could, you know, over time there could be a lot of moat characteristics with those. I think those are pretty obvious.
Yeah, I don't care how video consumption changes over time. The IP still translates.
Yep, for sure. All right, for sure. Five.
Costco. The model is so it's one of these idiosyncratic businesses that it's so unique in that you can buy all the – everyone knows sort of the story of how they make very little money on the product and they make all their money on their memberships.
Yeah, no gross profit dollars on membership. We all know this. The story gets told, it seems, every month, but it's a good one.
Yeah, and they've also taken steps to the corporate management of the company has been really, really strong. It's one where employees like working there, people like being there. And it's because they're paid well and they're making investments in their employees.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of companies are in the position to be able to do that.
Yeah. This isn't talked about much, and some people might argue it's not necessarily a competitive advantage or a moat, but I like to think about it a lot where building up not only the consumer brand equity, but the employee brand equity can be huge. You treat them well, give them good benefits, pay them whatever the average is at Costco. It's like $22 an hour, and that was 3-4 years ago. I bet it's like $25 on average now. So yeah, that can be a big advantage because it helps the consumers enjoy the process as well.
Yeah, especially at a grocery store. I think the mood among employees gets passed through to the customers. Mm-hmm. What's your fifth one?
Okay, my fifth is going to be Google. No matter what, like, you know, there's a lot of hate on Google. I guess, you know, you're a big company, you're going to get a lot of hate from, you know, news outlets, stuff like that. And I guess it's because Google kind of disrupted a lot of their business. You can see why they're angry. But I still believe Google has tremendous brand equity among consumers, among other things. And it also has, I believe, tremendous lock-in and economies of scale across a few of its products. I'll exclude GCP here because that's going to be one of my higher ones is going to be one of those cloud infrastructure players. But you look at YouTube, Search, Maps, Android, Chrome, and others I'm missing. I think they all have unique modes. Some have network effects. Some have switching costs. Some have economies of scale. I mean, search, you might not think like it, I think it definitely has economies of scale. If you look at, you know, there's a lot of people, and we're victims of it, that argue, oh, they have a data advantage. And a lot, I think 90% of the time it's kind of like, maybe they have a data, you know, like another company.
Sure.
But Google, I think they definitely do. You know, YouTube has one of the best network effects in the world, I believe. So, you know, overall, Google, I think, cracks my top five.
Yeah, I will definitely agree with that here shortly. My fourth one, though, is going to be Altria, pretty much for all the reasons you just claimed. It's such a difficult industry to compete in. One, there is regulatory hurdles, not only in that you can't just manufacture tobacco without the licenses, but you also, it's very hard to market your product. And there's literally customer addiction, so they tend to come back.
That reminds me of Starbucks too. I guess that's someone I didn't think about him. I don't think
I
it
thought
would
about
crack
putting him on the list, but I don't know. Just didn't crack the list.
It might be in my honorable mentions if I had time to think of those. Starbucks is, I mean, you can't deny the stock returns and the profits, but I don't think it's as strong as any in my top 10.
I have Starbucks every day. It probably should have gone to my
Yeah, I think I would argue it's stronger than Chipotle. I'm still going to nag you on that wild card pick.
But I'm not – yeah, I guess maybe it could have been my 10. But I'm also having – you know, it's the bags of coffee, not just the – I'm not, you know, going to the store. So don't think I'm one of those I'm saving money.
Yeah, Barbara Corcoran, if you're listening, don't worry. Ryan's on pace to become a millionaire by saving his $3 each day. Don't worry. Okay, I'll hit my fourth one. It's going to be TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor. Mm. I will think a lot of people would agree saying that they are number one in the world when it comes to economies of scale. Framing it in the mind of their competitors, it is going to take Intel, basically Samsung, I guess, does it as well. So there's a bit of a duopoly, but TSMC is number one. And then you have some Chinese brand companies that have been trying to do that, but really haven't gained market share. So it is going to take Intel, which is their only Western competitor. It's going to take them a few years and tens of billions of dollars to even try and catch up to their semiconductor manufacturing capabilities. And this is not guaranteed that they can. I just think the economies of scale with this business is going to be really, really hard to penetrate. Now, you could have argued that Intel had one in the 90s. Just like this. So there's a way it could get disrupted, maybe, but at least right now, it's really hard to see how anyone could penetrate this moat.
Yeah. Does ASML make your list?
No. I don't look. They may have the tech, whatever, they have the best tech in the world, but I don't believe technology is a competitive advantage. So,
hot take?
I don't think that's
a cold take, really.
No, I mean, tech can drive a good stock returns if it generates profit. I just don't think it's a long-term competitive, it's not a unique competitive advantage. It just means that you may be more innovative, and that's great. It doesn't mean, just because a company has a moat or doesn't have a moat doesn't make it a good or bad investment. It's just, might be a different reason.
Okay. My third one is Intuit.
Sneaky but good, I think, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like once you get old enough to do your taxes and you use TurboTax once, you're pretty much locked in for life. They thrive on FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And whether or not you think it's
fear
a good
from
moat,
whether you're doing it wrong, that's the fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those in crunch time, I think everyone just turns to TurboTax.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely there. Definitely there. People have tried to attack the moat for years. Hasn't really worked out. I don't know. I do hate the business, though.
I hate it, but I use it.
Yeah.
And I think most people, by default, just kind of, they're worried they're going to do it wrong, and they just, let's just trust TurboTax.
Yeah, well, is there government risk here if they ever decide to just kind of take everything in-house?
Maybe.
I mean, they
weren't these concerns cited, I don't know, 5-10 years ago?
No, that's the concern, yeah. I mean, it seems like the moat's there, but that is the concern with it. It could just go away overnight. But, obviously that's just theoretical. It might not actually be realistic and ever happening.
Yeah. I don't know if it ever will happen. I think the government should maybe own.
They'd probably make shareholders whole, if they ever did that.
Right. What's your third?
Okay, my third's going to be AWS, but you could include the three big cloud providers here. I guess Google's kind of a little bit smaller, but they're making their way here. I think they have three of the core moat characteristics that people talk about. They have brand equity. You might not think about that with AWS, but among their customers, they have tremendous brand equity. They have a tremendous economies of scale, and they have probably, you could argue, I bet, we said Autodesk and products like that have some of the highest switching costs in the world. I think these companies do have the highest switching costs in the world. You could imagine, say, okay, Netflix is like AWS's largest customer, or at least one of them. You could imagine it would cost Netflix like $1 billion in cash or more to switch from AWS to someone else. And that is not counting any of the non-cash expenses or the risk to the brand if the product deteriorates because you're transitioning to something else.
Yeah. Spotify's, if you listen to that Spotify episode where they signed on with Google Cloud, It's hell trying to switch.
It's hell, and
once you do, you don't want to do it again.
Yeah, and it is also kind of why the adoption's been just kind of steady. And I realized it this year is why it's been just so steady, and it just didn't just kind of happen overnight like people just switching to Google Chrome or whatever. Everyone seemed to switch within 2 to 3 years' time is because the legacy solutions have high switching costs. So it does take, the legacy solutions or whatever those are.
Migration takes time.
Yes, the migration, yeah, and but it's really tough to leave. It's kind of like you can't almost once you get to a big enough scale.
And it's expensive to start one. which is why Microsoft, Google, and Amazon are the big
providers. And like people like IBM have really failed. Maybe that's just, I don't know, they seem to fail at a lot of it, execution these days, but yeah.
All right, my second one is Ferrari.
Good one.
I think they're very, it's really, really hard to replicate what they've done. The history is something that's kind of ingrained in the culture. It's just, you can't really repeat the, they get a lot of pricing power because of the events, because of what the brand means. The exclusivity helps make people feel prestigious. That's really hard to replicate. And not to mention they have the racing history has kind of become a huge part of
them. They haven't won in 10 years, though. So,
and it hasn't affected them.
No, it hasn't. I know. That doesn't really matter. That doesn't matter to them, but... Yeah, the racing stuff, it's a part of it too. Yeah, I think it makes sense. It would take decades to replicate the model because it took decades for Ferrari to build up their, and I've used this 20 times, so roll your eyes if you want, but the brand equity with their consumers, it takes decades to build.
Yeah, and then, you know, once you, you don't want to miss buying one. If you're like a loyal user, or not a loyal user, a loyal member
customer,
that Ferrari club.
Yeah. So, well, theoretically, I mean, some members, some people might be one-time purchasers, but yeah.
All right. What's your number two?
Okay. It's going to be Visa. I think they have the ultimate network effect. Number one, and I think it's almost undisputed number one network effect in the world. I mean, you have the most cross use cases among both sides of the marketplace, merchants and consumers. You have embedded switching costs. You have extremely high frequency of use, a low take rate, similar to, say, Costco or something, where they could. I mean, they have the pricing power there, but they really just take those thin margins, which basically makes it. I mean, it's impossible. There's no way you can put MasterCard here too. There's no way within the card space that you could disrupt these players. I think the proof is in the upkeep costs. Their core business basically has minimal operating expenditures, and it kind of rounds to zero, you know, since they're so big. I mean, it might be, you know, a few hundred million dollars, but to them, that's basically zero. And they have no capital needs, and yet they keep chugging along each year, and no one comes on to, you know, disrupt them. Now, there's a little bit of a durability risk. You know, a lot of people talk about whether cards are going to go out of favor over the next decade, whether buy now, pay later is going to come in, crypto, if QR codes are going to take over, whatever. But that's not really what the moat is evaluating, like we're saying. Within the core card business, I don't want to say no way, but it seems like it's 100%, not 100%, but pretty damn close for them to stick around.
Yeah, it's definitely a top moat, and I probably would have had it on there.
You just forgot?
I thought you were going to put it on there anyway, so I figured we'd talk about it. But my number one's going to be Google. You already mentioned it. Search. If I had to bet on any big tech piece of big tech or whatever to be here in 25 years, it'd be Google Search.
What about Maps? You put there too?
No.
No? How would they go?
I don't think Google Maps has as much market share as Google Search. I don't think it's that differentiated than Apple Maps.
I would argue Apple Maps is pretty bad. Google Maps is a lot better.
You don't use Apple Maps.
I have an iPad. I've used it before. It's pretty bad.
I use it on the go and every day. It's fine. It does the job.
Well, I said Google Maps probably. Google Search's market share is like 80%. I think Maps is probably similar.
No.
Because Bing has surprisingly high market share. You'd be surprised at how much it has. But I guess
I don't think so. I don't think Maps has. It's not that much. I don't feel a difference. I've downloaded Google Maps. I've downloaded Apple Maps. It's pre-installed. I still use Apple Maps.
I don't know. I guess that's just kind of
most
subjective.
Apple users I know use Apple Maps.
I don't know. There's a lot. I mean,
the product doesn't seem that much better. But Search, I think, is basically the most impenetrable moat of any offering, maybe in the world.
I think Maps embedded on the whatever the market share on Android phones is, I think it's going to be the same. But agree to disagree.
All right, what's yours?
Okay, Costco, I have for number one. You already talked about most of this. Yeah, I mean, they have basically everything but network effects, economies of scale, brand equity built up over decades. The extremely thin margins act as a moat as well. You know, I think the question I kind of like to ask if I'm thinking, all right, what does this company have a competitive advantage? You kind of like, and basically with all these companies, you kind of ask like, all right, if you were given $10 billion right now, or maybe a little higher for bigger companies or smaller for a smaller company, like if someone gave you $10 billion right now, how would you go about dethroning this business with the same business model, like, or similar model, you know, attacking the same customer with a similar product, like not trying to just innovate with a different, you know, way of going about things, like with crypto or something for Visa. If you can't come up with anything, I think the moat is likely strong. That's kind of the question I have with Costco. Like, how would you do it?
You can't. And so, that's why it's atop the moat list. And that's probably why it tends to trade at a premium over its entire life it has. So,
yeah.
Well, I guess hindsight it is a premium, but
yeah, the
feels like a premium in the time.
That's true. Yeah, and I guess that's the question. Yeah, look, yeah, when looking at this top 10, don't think like, all right, I'm going to listen to this. This is the top 10. These are obviously all good investments. You know, a lot of the times, I think most of these here traded at premium valuation, and for good reason, is because the moat has developed over time.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's our top 10. Just so everyone knows, we don't own most of them. So obviously not recommendations, but
Maybe we should.
We're going to hit a quick break, and then we've got our traditional show notes on the second half. All right, welcome back in. I'm going to kick things off. Muddy Waters released a short report on Lemonade this week. Fascinating one, kind of a battleground stock. I guess you could say there's passionate shareholders, and then there's people that obviously don't believe in the business as much. But Muddy Waters opened their letter, or I should say...
video, right? Was it a video?
It was a letter. It was a letter to Dan Schreiber. But they released a video afterwards that showed what the problem was. But he opened his letter with, "Dear Mr. Schreiber, who is the CEO of Lemonade, Muddy Waters LLC is short Lemonade because it is clear that Lemonade does not give a..." You guys can fill in the blank about securing its customers' sensitive personal information. I thought that was a hell of an opening. It's not really how I open my letters.
A lot of this times, you know, we've seen it with the lobe letters in the past, the third point letters. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the typical tactic is to, you, part of it is to try to get under people's skin, make them act irrationally and get angry. That's kind of,
It may have worked because, I'll talk about the basis of the report, which was that Lemonade's website contains, and I have this in quotes, "an unforgivably negligent security flaw that exposes personal information." So Muddy Waters basically said that Lemonade should take its website down because it's exposing personal information, and they have notified the various regulators, which I always find funny. Like, that was a mistake we told on you.
But
that's their job. Anyway, I don't really understand the complexities or the intricacies of the security problem and what sort of they violated. It sounds like it was just a security flaw on personal information. But Shay, who's an exec and I believe a co-founder at Lemonade, followed the short report up by stating that the quotes, as in their insurance quotes, that they found were shareable, and they said it wasn't a vulnerability, but it was by design. And so he's basically saying this was I hope you didn't spend a lot of time on this because it was like a blatant error. But Muddy Waters came back and said this was a big mistake. We see through this lie. Response forthcoming, and then invited them on to CNBC for a debate, which I did not see a response to. This came after a secondary raise from Lemonade, and the CEO has sold $48 million worth of stock. Now, I don't know if this is a security issue, but do you think – I mean, how would you respond if you were a CEO and a short report came out? What do you think of Shay's response? How about that?
I tend to – in this golden age of fraud, I tend to not believe, you know, I side on the fact of not believing the executives, just because there's been such a history of negligence among regulators right now that it seems like there's a lot of potential fraud going out there. And I don't know anything about Lemonade, but it seems like the ideal thing is to either just do kind of a one letter that's short back, like 2-3 pages, make it short, and then not like a short report, but like short in length, refute it respectfully and say, we'll execute over the next 3 years to prove you wrong. The business is going to be fine. And then just go about your business and ignore them because, you know, whatever. That's all you can control.
You think it's
when
worth
people
responding?
Get personally, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Let's say you don't respond and the stock collapses. Why don't you just buy back the shares if you think it trades under its value?
Yeah, that's kind of the thing here. I was surprised Muddy Waters didn't just go for valuation concerns because valuation
short,
is
short because it feels overvalued.
Yeah, I mean that's not much of a headline, I guess. But the right isn't Lemonade. The big argument isn't really. The big argument is that the business model isn't. It's that it's just online and that they're trading at a crazy multiple. So
something that tends to grind my gears a little bit is when sometimes I feel like short reports come out with like some harsh thesis about like whether it, like management is malevolent or
fraud or
whatever,
stealing or yeah.
When in reality it's overvalued.
Yeah.
And they know they can kind of take advantage of that. But
who knows? They might be right, though. I don't know who's right. We'll see.
Yeah, that's true. The other thing I would say, and maybe I don't understand the problem enough, but let's say this was a problem and it was bad and they just took the site down and changed it real quick and then put it back online. Does that really change the business that much?
No.
Is it worth being short just because of one security issue?
Yeah. I don't know. Well, maybe it's worse than I was surprised. I watched the little short video and I was like, huh, I would have thought you would have just said 50 times sales. Yeah.
I don't know.
That's all you know, 40 times sales. You know, if this gets cut in half, it's at 25 times sales. That's it. That's all we need, guys. But that's not as exciting. I don't know. There's been a lot of accusations against Lemonade, right? Because they are kind of that disruptor. It'll be interesting to see if they are successful over the next few years.
All right, what's your story?
Okay, Marqeta filed its S-1. This is a fintech stock. Very interesting company. I'm reminded of the latest Bill Gurley quote. I think we may have been discussing this offline, but he basically said at some interview, he's like, you know what, guys? Well, if the public markets want fintech stocks trading at 30 times sales, we'll give you as many as we can. And he's a venture capitalist, so he's kind of the one giving it to them. That reminded me of this, so I think it's probably going to be one that's just going to trade a valuation that keeps us possibly out of there. But their mission, it's an interesting business model, is to be the global standard for modern card issuing. So they work with other companies to issue cards and have these API plugins to add different features quickly that they can offer customers. Value prop seems to be speed versus legacy card issuing, but it feels a bit like a middleman. Some people were arguing that they could be easily replaced if, say, one of their largest customers like Square just went direct to the bank partners here, but who knows, they're not. So far, they have more than 320 million cards issued. Customers include Uber, DoorDash, Affirm, Square, and I wrote assuming Afterpay because they weren't listed, but I think I confirmed that Afterpay uses them too. 103% sales growth last year, $118 million in gross profit last year, so Sai, we're probably going to get a $4 or $5 billion valuation, but that's okay. They take about 0.2% of the card transactions. That's their take rate. So for the value they're providing, they're just taking some of that off the top. Say when Square, the cash card or whatever, uses a makes a purchase. Interestingly, 70% of their net revenue comes from Square. So they maybe think, Square's paying them all this money. Could Square buy them out and save themselves a lot of money, just kind of integrate this and make this part of their financial services go B2B with this? Why not?
They probably could. They just had a convertible offering today. So
interesting. That could be exciting.
There you go.
Well,
it's acquisition money.
Yeah, because people are talking about Affirm, because Peloton uses Affirm, and Peloton has similar, I don't think it's as high, but it has customer concentration, or Affirm, excuse me, has customer concentration with Peloton. And people are arguing, like, all right, well, Affirm is just kind of a simple, and they're the buy now, pay later thing. They're just the simple API connecting, you know, Peloton to the bank. Seems like a very simple product to be worth that much. And people are arguing, you know, Marqeta is just an API for Square and Sutton Bank, their bank partner. But who knows? They're obviously providing a lot of value. But I haven't looked at the full S1. I just kind of glanced at some of the highlights. But on this face, what are your thoughts on this business? It seems, you know, I don't know.
I don't totally understand it. It feels like that 4% or whatever that comes off every transaction, how there's
the banks, 2.7
cards.
Yeah.
Then there's Marqeta, and then there's just like these 0.2, 0.1. It feels like that's getting pretty crowded. And I'm not sure who has leverage in that tiny little transaction space.
Well, if we want to go earlier, it's probably Visa and MasterCard.
Yeah. There's always some new avenue of fintech that I didn't know existed. And I guess this is one of them. So,
yeah, I don't know. I thought it looked promising, but there was a few questions. Yeah, on the durability concerns. I don't know. And that sort of customer concentration, no matter like how bullish you are on, say, Square's prospects or whatever, I just don't know if you can.
No, it's a serious risk.
It's such a risk. I don't know.
Maybe
because you could hold them hostage. It's kind of what Microsoft did with Nuance Communications, right? Where they're like, we're going to buy you out for this much.
Or we're gonna drive you
from Azure or whatever. Yeah. Oh, well, that wasn't publicly said. People were assuming that happened. Yeah.
All right. Okay, I found something interesting this week. I kind of came across this. I don't know how I saw it. I guess maybe you'd call this a current state of FinTwit or something like that. But the title here is "It's All About Tax Deductions." So Aldi's, which is like a discount grocer, it's pretty big on the East Coast. It's not very big over here, but it was founded in 1946 in Germany. The CEO was named Theo Albrecht. Apparently, in 1971, he was kidnapped and held for ransom for 17 days. They asked for 7 million German marks, which is like equivalent, I think it was equivalent to $2 million in ransom money for his release. Apparently, he was held at gunpoint. The ransom was eventually paid. He was let go. Half the money ended up being recovered. They found the two people that kidnapped him. And afterwards, Albrecht attempted to claim the ransom money as a tax-deductible business expense. It did not go through. Is this the kind of frugality and cost consciousness you like to see out of a CEO?
I don't know. But it's a funny story.
Should this have been a business expense? Should this be tax-deductible?
I don't know, but yeah, that is the kind of mindset I think you want from a CEO. I don't know.
Putting yourself
in a situation to get kidnapped is kind of tough. I guess probably could happen to anyone, but I don't know. I mean, that's weird. It doesn't seem like he would be a big, you know, like target for this type of stuff.
Maybe Aldi's is bigger in Europe than we. Realize.
Yeah, he could be.
Because he was kidnapped in Germany.
Okay, maybe they're like the big dog over there. Yeah, huh, that's quite the story. It's almost weird. I don't know.
So apparently it isn't tax deductible, but doesn't it seem like if the company's paying that out to save their CEO, couldn't that be considered a business expense?
It should be an expense. I mean, we were talking about that with the pipeline that paid the $5 million in crypto Bitcoin.
Is that tax deductible?
I mean, it should just be an expense, right, that goes against your net income, right? I would think so, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, it reminds me, this never happens anymore, or rarely, I guess. But in the olden days, there was like the Standard Oil types, kind of the big trust. Sometimes there would be assassination attempts against some of the managers there because of all, you know, in that day, we were talking about treating your employees well. In those days, there was a lot of evidence that they weren't treating their employees well, and that led to the rise of, you know, a lot of workers being upset for working 12-hour days in the horrid conditions. And there was like the assassination attempts on these people, and they almost die. And it's almost like thinking about how, say, there's an assassination attempt on like Sundar Pichai or something like that. That's how crazy that was. And it was not like a normal occurrence, but it happened like with decent frequency.
Huh.
And I guess this is kind of similar.
What's your next story?
Okay, so we have Druck and Miller, but I put the N in there, parentheses, Drunken Miller, as we jokingly like to call him. He had his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Did you get to read it, or was it not in your paper version?
I must have missed it.
I think it was probably before then you got your paper version, which I'll have to pick up if you kept any. I'm going to have to get your leftovers.
Yeah, well, I'll maybe give you a few of them. They're starting to come in frequently.
Well, what are you going to keep any for?
Memorabilia. The inflation.
You're going to keep them
all? The inflation crisis of last week.
You're going to keep them all, most as memorabilia. You're going to stack it up like a collector.
Well, any one of them could have been the top. And I want to save that day.
All right. Okay. Well, that's a little bit strange and upsetting. But he had his op-ed and CNBC appearance, and he basically came on to complain, like he always does. But he's one of the best of all time, so it's kind of always interesting to listen. Usually has some interesting stuff, and it's macro talk, so way out of our league. And I'll start by saying, whatever he said, I'm not confident either way that he's right or wrong, but he had some good theories. He called out the fiscal policy of the last year, $6 trillion in stimulus, and then monetary policy, which, you know, zero interest rates, pushing everyone out to riskier assets. Well, I guess that's subjective if you want to call Dogecoin a riskier asset, but to each his own. He called it the craziest policy he's ever seen. This is a direct quote. I can't find any period in history where monetary and fiscal policy were this out of step with the economic circumstances, not one. Essentially, his data and evidence was this. $2.5 trillion in QE post-vaccine confirmation, which has led to an absurd boost in retail spending and led to an asset bubble. I think both of those are true. Like, they're really not hard to, really hard to argue against those. And all in the name of getting an arbitrary CPI number from 1.4% to 2%, which he deemed as nonsensical, where it's like, you know, these aren't exact numbers. What's the big deal about this 2% thing? We're going to mortgage everything else, you know, create all these other problems just to get to 2%. That's kind of what he was yelling about. And I do think there's some nuances and whatever. There's some things that we don't understand, but I'm pretty highly confident that he is directionally correct here. What are your thoughts?
I do find it funny that everyone, there's so much talk about how people, like, America's hasn't had the inflation that we should.
And it's like, why?
We're not spending enough.
Yeah, it says why we want that inflation.
But things were going well.
Yeah.
I didn't think we had that many problems. Maybe I'm just tone deaf and not aware of them. But I don't know if, like, I don't know if the $2.5 trillion QE is worth it.
Especially post-vaccine. I think that totally makes sense. I don't know.
But
like,
then,
why?
But
why?
Then you look at his portfolio and it hasn't really changed.
Oh, well, he's, yeah,
just,
I mean,
long big tech. Isn't,
yeah,
it? Am I getting that right? He had owned Amazon and something else.
Yeah, yeah, he, I don't want to speak for what he owns, but I believe he had 30% in Microsoft. It kind of, I don't know, in his family office. Yeah, he said he's been doing, he had his best year in a long time. And he, you know, he blamed the policy. But the, yeah, it seems like, all right, they have this target. They're like, all right, we need this inflation rate. We're going to not stop until we do. But you got to think about the side effects, right? Of, like, you know, there are long-term consequences of asset bubbles. And, you know, while it's likely not as bad as the dot-com bubble or whatever it was, I mean, they still have consequences if some of these smaller ones were, you know, that can hurt. I don't know. And there's other things like, I don't know, the debt kind of matters at some point, maybe. I don't know. No, a lot of people seem to think now, the common sense now.
Debt never matters.
Yeah, the common sense seems to be to think that it never matters. I don't know.
People have been saying that for 30 years that it matters. Probably longer than that.
Well, now it seems that the common sense is that it doesn't. It kind of switched, strangely. I don't know. We'll see.
Trillion,
I hope.
Who cares?
I hope. Yeah, I hope it's fine. I hope it's fine. But it seems like maybe the Fed should
just
listen to
maturity.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like everyone, they don't have much, like, criticism at the Fed where they're all on the same page, and that kind of scares me. We're like, yeah. You know, no one has any dissenting opinions, even if it was like some gold bug, which I kind of disagree with too. But I don't know. Well, what's your next story?
Elon started a war. So this is anecdotal evidence.
I will admit, I was extremely happy on Sunday reading this stuff.
So if you're not aware, last week Elon Musk, I guess, I assume people know him, but Elon tweeted out a notice that Tesla won't be allowing Bitcoin payments anymore, citing environmental concerns. The reason that we find this so interesting is because when they accepted Bitcoin, started accepting Bitcoin, even prior to that, people liked Elon Musk and they liked Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin and Tesla basically became synonymous with one another.
And they put that $1.5 billion on the balance sheet.
Right. And now it's essentially forced followers to pick sides. And there was a lot of backlash this week on Twitter. I honestly felt bad for him, but he gets criticism all the time. I don't think he's a victim. I think he's okay.
I think he's more of a predator than a victim, or
but whatever.
Sorry, that was bad.
Not a predator. I think that might be the wrong word.
Predator, not predator, like in the way that people are
predatory.
I
suppose
predatory to people that believe in his product a lot. You know,
but I've seen a lot of it's more anecdotal evidence, but I saw a lot of tweets where people were like, thanks a lot, I'm canceling my Cybertruck order. It's like, wow.
Oh, yeah. $100. Ooh.
Stuck it to him.
Yeah, you're not going to get that by 2027? Ooh.
And then also, like, for just friends that used to kind of, you know, praise him were like, you know, I'm honestly not that impressed after his SNL appearance and then this environmental concerns over Bitcoin.
And you're like, welcome to the club?
It just feels like he maybe maybe ruined his relationship with a lot of his followers, which does in a way drive Tesla. And I think you're seeing that today with the stock price. I guess we were looking at it. It was down like, 3% this morning. Bitcoin, if you think it doesn't matter, it's been down like 20% since he tweeted this. So
yeah. Well, the core thing, you know, whether there's all these nuances of who likes what, who's intellectually right or whatever, a lot of people have a lot of wealth built up in Bitcoin, and when someone can just say something and eliminate 20% of it, I don't think there's any reason to think they won't all get upset. I would be upset, because selfishly, I think, you know, everyone would have to admit that they are happy that Bitcoin made them wealthy, and they don't want anyone upsetting that.
Yeah, no, big time.
I don't know.
Who do you think's more loyal to their holdings, Bitcoin owners or Tesla shareholders?
Bitcoiners, for sure.
Yeah, I've respect, never seen as quite a passionate as crowd.
Yes, it's so passionate. You have to really respect how – now there's some pumpers out there that we can't name. But, they're, you know, you have to respect how dedicated – yes, yes.
Sorry.
I understand what you mean there. But the dedication they have, you have to respect how much they love it. And it's a core part of their, you know, kind of belief system of how the world should work, and whether you agree or disagree, they're way more, you know, into it, and they're dedicated, and they put a ton of time and effort at Tesla shareholders as well. But that's less of a, you know, sometimes it's just like someone's big investment or something like that. It's not like a core part of their lifestyle. Well, I don't know. Some people are.
I guess.
I don't know.
I do think once something has made you fabulously wealthy, I think it inherently becomes a part of your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Which for some of the people, it has done quite well.
There's so many things I want to say about this, but, you know, but I don't want to upset our listeners.
You know who was right all along, and I guess we should have seen it coming? Michael Burry.
Yeah. There was that thing about today about
his inflation worries, Tesla puts.
Yeah, he put it in today.
Was he anti-Bitcoin?
No, I think he's pretty new. No, I don't want to say. I forget. He had something. I don't think it was crazy long or short, but who knows? Read what he had to say. Actually, he deleted all his tweets, so maybe not. But yeah, in his portfolio, it said notional value of his Tesla put options were 40% of the portfolio, which in reality, it's probably like 4 or 5%. But, you know, options, you know, whatever. The contracts are usually a lot less than the actual notional value of the shares. So 40% is a lot larger than it actually is. But he made a big bet there. And he also...
he's been right thus far. I mean...
yeah, he had put options on, I believe, TLT, which is the Treasury ETF. So that would be a bet on inflation.
He's been...
I think so, yeah.
I think he's like the pinnacle or sort of the peak example of how hard it is to be truly contrarian in the moment. Because you get hate from so many people.
He got a lot of hate. Yeah, he did. He doesn't care, though.
Yeah. I think being off Twitter is probably good for him.
Well, it's probably, yeah, because, I mean, the reason we're on Twitter is to learn and build up this show and get ideas. But if you're someone that's kind of, he's already an expert, you know, you would say.
I would, yeah.
You kind of don't want that clouding of your opinions. You know, people are going to be saying you're wrong constantly. I wish he was still on, though, because it's fun to have him on. Although although he's a bit crazier than I thought from the movie. He is a
It's a damn shame, but
he is a little crazy. But you got to respect his track record.
All right, what's your last story?
Okay, yeah, this one's a fun one. The Vision Fund is back. I guess this would have been a hot water for us. So, you know, last one or two, three years ago, everyone, including us, had written off the SoftBank Vision Fund. Everyone, including us, was making fun of those investment slides, which are always great. The unicorn trough, the arrows just pointing up that are very cartoonish. But, you know, the WeWork stuff and the mobility investments look bad at the time. But, and I guess we'd also worry about the Saudi investment fund that could get into a sticky situation. I think he was probably sweating that one out, given the history of their actions when things don't go their way. But however, they've had kind of a turnaround. Cumulative return of the Vision Fund, which was $100 billion, is now 1.64 times the original investment. Not phenomenal, but, you know, pretty good. Return of 3.85 times on listed investments, which is stuff that I believe that means publicly traded. So that's $15 billion to $60 billion. And they've basically broken even on their private investments, although some of the carrying values may be lower than what they would get in the public markets. You know, investment deck, we made fun of it. It proved to be true. Some of these investments worked out. It's kind of crazy.
Well, yeah, so they were a big backer in Grab, right?
Everything, yes.
Grab and Coupang.
Grab, Coupang, everything. Didi.
It's almost hard to be wrong when you have that much money, because when you get something that's super capital intensive to scale and not many people can do it because they don't have the money, and you back it.
Yeah. Well, they backed
you
Uber.
You can make it happen with the money.
They backed Uber and DoorDash, which is like, yeah, we both won, you know.
Yeah, but like Coupang, you know, building out all those facilities, they couldn't – I'm not sure that Coupang would be what Coupang is today without SoftBank's money.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much – what the percentage of their investment was. But
same with Grab.
Possibly, yeah.
Which I guess if you have that kind of money, those are kind of the investments you want to dabble in, right? Because it's harder for people to reach that scale.
And if you have $100 billion, you can't be doing seed investments.
Small deals.
On some P2P software company that has like a $2 million customer base. I mean,
yeah, but I would take the private investments with a grain of salt, since they probably do the series. They bit them up.
Oh, they have bit them up. Yeah, I guess, yeah. Some of them, I was saying the carrying value might be lower, but I guess that might even out if they do some of that WeWork shenanigans, as we might want to call them.
It's worth $1 billion today. A year from now, we're going to do another round at $3 billion.
Yeah, I don't know, man. $100 billion.
Masa-san might be the best investor who portrays himself poorly.
Yeah, his track record's pretty good. There's a lot of smart investors that pitch SoftBank too, the company as an investment, just because it's kind of one of those sum of the parts things.
Yeah.
Seems too big though. But I would caveat the end of this that all the excitement around SoftBank, everything, it's been such a big story for 5 years. His LPs have far likely underperformed a US index fund. That was just take them 2 minutes to do. All this stuff. Maybe it's exciting and it's fun. But, you know, you kind of think about that, you know, we could have just bought.
I've always thought if I was fabulously wealthy, I would just index.
Yeah, but it's not fun. It's not fun, though.
That's true. Life's too short to index.
That's true. That's the mindset. It's just not as fun. But I think you look back at something like this, I don't know, I guess maybe $100 billion, like you can't index that. That's just too much for one person. It would take years and years and years to do that. But who knows? I don't know. Good story. You kind of hope SoftBank doesn't implode, because you don't want anything to implode, right? But there's still the worries of that. Maybe less than there were 2 years ago, though.
Certainly. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. Thank you all for listening. We do, I believe we have interviews kind of coming up for the foreseeable future.
Futures, CE Limited and Coupang discussion with someone with boots on the ground, right?
Yes.
So that should be exciting.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, we are general partners at Arch Capital. Partners there may have positions in the securities discussed on this podcast. We are not financial advisors. Anything we say or discuss here on Chit Chat Money is not formal advice or recommendation. Feel free to get in touch with us wherever you can find us, Twitter, our email, anything like that. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next time.